Good morning.
Good morning.
Ooh, here we are. So, let me just get myself adjusted here. So, I do various types of Dharma talks. Sometimes I talk about a koan, or sometimes I talk about an incident from the Buddha's life. Sometimes I talk about some basic Buddhist principle. Sometimes I tell stories from my personal experience. Sometimes I just kind of do these meditations where I start in one weird place and wind up in another weird place. And sometimes my talks are about how to do this stuff. And I think these are my favorite talks because I think they may be the most helpful to you and me both. Often in a Dokusan, which is a private meeting between a Zen teacher and a Zen student, things will come up. This is where I'm at. This is what's troubling me. This is where I'd like a little guidance as to where to go. Or maybe I just want to talk through it. And sometimes I come up with, or we come up with, a decent answer. And it occurs to me that others might share a similar situation and that it might be worthwhile to kind of work these things into a talk. And, of course, I never reveal who has inspired a certain topic, and I don't reveal any identifying details. And usually it's the experience of a few people combined that inform these things, combined with my own experience as well. And I'm so grateful to the people that I have these interactions with. It may be in Dokusan, it may be on the front porch, it may be in the backyard, but when people open themselves up to me, and I open myself up in response, it takes some courage, I think, and it takes some heart, and it feels like it's a great privilege for me, and I learn so much myself. And I have to say that I really love my students, and I really love everyone I interact with here. I love this sangha. And it's interesting, isn't it, that this little interaction we might have in Dokusan, or maybe on the front porch, or maybe in the backyard, can be something, can become part of something much much larger, with many currents that could affect many people. And family is the same way. Friends at work are the same way. But here at Zen Center, I think we kind of distill it down. We get to the real stuff. I love getting to the real stuff. I've never been very good at small talk, and I've never enjoyed it. So my subject today is dealing with habit energy. And here's how I'm going to start. I'm going to start by talking about how beautiful things are this time of year. Bear with me, I'll get to the habit energy part soon enough. So it really is a beautiful time of the year. And as I'm saying this, I can see the leaves outside the window in the Founders Hall just swaying beautifully. It's a nice windy morning. It's a cold morning, which is beautiful and a little confusing after we had that 100-degree weather not long ago. But I hope you're finding ways to be simply present with this beautiful time of year. I hope you're not too distracted to see it. And I say that based on experience, because I myself often get distracted. And I think in my life I've missed whole seasons before. Like, wow, that was fall. I don't know if I ever really got to enjoy that. And as I get older, I try a little harder not to miss anything. So I think it was only 7 or 8 weeks ago that we had that massive May snowstorm. So our spring has seemed really, really short. And it kind of seems like it's still spring, but it's June 3rd and we're moving into summer. And we have grasses and shrubs and wildlife and flowers that are just burgeoning. At home, Kathy and I, we have on each side of our front walk, pink peonies, and they're huge right now. They're so big that the plants are bending over from the weight, and they're just magnificent. We had to stake them up. And on our back deck, we have kind of a double deck, so there's a sort of a roof on our back deck, and there's a robin that's moved in there, and she's built a nest, and she's feeding her little babies, and we'll be sitting there having dinner, and about 5 feet above us, this robin's coming in and out, and we can hear the babies squalling, and she's tolerating us okay, and I think the babies are going to make it. For the Memorial Day weekend, we drove down the Mississippi, and we went to Trempealeau, Wisconsin, which is a place we like to hang out. And we went canoeing on the Black River, and it was beautiful. It was 95 degrees, but it was beautiful. And we went to a national wildlife refuge down there, and I saw something that I've read about, but I've never seen before. And that was these two young bald eagles. They were kind of flying around together and kind of doing this weird dance in the air. And then they locked their talons and went into a free fall. And just before they hit the ground, they parted. Has anyone ever seen this? No. I've read about it, but I had never seen it. And it was just a magnificent thing to see. You know, what a beautiful world where we can see such a thing. I think it's kind of a territorial thing. I think it's kind of like a game of chicken, but I'm not sure. So another reason I think this time of year is so nice is it's graduation season. And graduations are really fun. The parents are so proud, and the graduates are so excited, and they're so kind to each other, usually. And families get together. And here in Minnesota, what you do sometimes is you build a shrine in the garage, and you put you start with their first grade pictures, and you have all their trophies and ribbons, and then you have your party out in the garage. So how many of you have attended or will attend a graduation or graduation party this spring? Yeah, quite a few people. We had one in our family. Our grandson Alonzo. He's the little guy that I learned to swim with, and I did a Dharma talk on that a few years back. Well, he's grown up now. He's 18, and Kathy has given him so very much support all of his life. And his graduation day was one of the great days of her life, and we're both so proud of him. And June is the month of weddings. Anybody have a wedding to go to this spring or summer? Not too many. Well, I have three, so I just thought, well, I guess everybody must have a bunch of weddings. I have three. I'm pretty lucky. So my wish for all of us this time of year is I hope that every one of us can really enjoy this beautiful time of year, that we can be present for it. We don't have to savor it. We don't have to take a picture of it. We don't even have to remember it. In fact, trying to do these things, might interfere with our enjoyment of it. We just have to be present in an undistracted way. And what could stop us from doing that? Well, one thing that can stop us from doing that is habit energy, which is my subject today. And some of us are more prone to this than others. I suspect all of us have it to some degree. So what is habit energy? Thich Nhat Hanh uses that phrase a lot, and I think in a very helpful way. He talks about recognizing that you act in habitual ways and that you can have a richer life if you can learn to not be governed so much by your habits. So for a definition, I would say that a habit is a way of reacting to something based on your past experience rather than on present conditions. And that's not necessarily bad. Habits are useful and helpful. They can be pleasant. I'm kind of a creature of habit. When I lived in Northfield, I went to Goodbye Blue Monday coffee shop several times a week, and every time I would sit at the same table, was available. I would write in the same kind of journal. I would get the same bagel with cream cheese, and I'd get the same cup of coffee. And I did that over and over for years. And, sometimes I'd get an onion bagel, sometimes I'd get sesame, but that's about, you know, as far as I went when it came to varying things. And I liked the predictability. I didn't have to think about things. I knew what worked, so why change it? And habit can be very comforting if we're having a hard time or if we're grieving. Habits can help us get through when we're fatigued. We kind of go on autopilot, and we do what needs to be done, and we don't have to rethink the situation anew. And also the word habit can be used in a very positive sense of, I'm going to form a new habit. I'm going to meditate 10 minutes every day for the next 30 days, and I think then it'll turn into a habit. And that's a very useful thing to do. But habits can also be harmful. And I'm thinking about a particular type of habit energy that I think of as kind of a relentless driving forward of activity. I've got to get this thing done. I am always a little uptight because I know I should be doing something. So it's kind of a fierce compulsion to keep fixing things or putting things in order or working toward concrete results. It's like doing the list. I've always got the list. I've got to complete the list. When I went on a 5-day retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh a long time ago, it was probably over 10 years ago, that's the kind of habit energy he encouraged us to notice. And it was remarkable that over the course of this 5-day retreat, I saw this habit energy receding in myself and in other people as well. They settled into mindful walking, mindful eating, mindful conversation, and a little bit of meditation over that 5 days, and it was kind of liberating. And I'm pretty familiar with this kind of habit energy myself because I'm prone to it. And I'm going to give you a very simple example, which involves driving. So I have a very busy schedule, as you may know, and I go from home in St. Paul to my job in Eagan, for a couple more weeks anyway, and then here to Zen Center. So I spend a lot of time on I-35 and the crosstown, which is 62, and I-94. So sometimes I'll come to Zen Center in the morning, I'll go to work, and I'll come back here in the evening, and then I go home. So I need to keep things pretty tight so I can get everything done. So I drive under a little pressure. You know, I drive with a little pressure. I don't tailgate, never do that, but I speed a little bit. Now, I don't speed a lot because a Zen center can't be speeding a lot. That would be antisocial. But I don't stick to the speed limit because that would be really rigid. And that's not right for a Zen teacher either. So I speed just a little bit. And like most people, I kind of press for advantage. Like, you know, I'll kind of dart into that lane. I'll dart into that lane. If I beat that person, it could affect what'll happen a mile down the road, you know. So driving's a little bit like playing a video game. And I think maybe my driving's kind of gentle compared to most people. But still, I do that sort of pressure thing. And the only difference between me and someone who's really, is one of degree. So driving that way gets me there a little faster, but there's kind of a psychic cost, too. I can feel when I do that that it kind of affects me. It kind of gets my nervous system going in a non-helpful way. And it has an effect on other drivers as well. I'm bringing a little more tension into the world. I'm creating karma when I do that. Well, we all make calculations as to when a little hurrying is the right thing to do, a little tension, a little lack of mindfulness, even a little aggression sometimes might be necessary or helpful. Sometimes we just got to do it. I've got to be on time for my own talk, whether I'm a priest or not. But the thing about this kind of driving is that often, well, I tend to do it all of the time, and it is habitual. That's the important thing to note about it. I do it even when there is no reason to do it. If I have plenty of time to go from work to Zen Center and no particular reason to get to Zen Center early, I am likely to still do that thing, still press for advantage out of sheer habit. And I probably don't even notice that I'm doing that. And that's really too bad because I miss what could be some mindful time in the car. I don't see the clouds. I'm a little worked up when I don't need to be, and I'm contributing to the general level of tension out there on the road. So hurrying when you need to hurry is not bad. Hurrying when you don't need to hurry is the result of habit energy, which is destructive. And of course, this can happen in many aspects of our lives, not just in driving, that we habitually surge forward even when we don't need to. I was talking to someone recently who said, and I'm exaggerating here a little bit for effect, but this person said, "Oh my God, I've just started paying attention to these things, and I'm beginning to realize that my whole life I've just had this driving forward kind of energy where I've got to get the next thing done, and I've got to get my list of things completed, and it's my total focus, and it's always there, and I'm afraid I'm going to miss my life, but I'm also afraid to stop because I don't know what will happen if I stop." And I said, "Yes, that's the way it is." And I said, "You know, I think it's worth the risk. I think stopping is worth the risk. There is the risk that something bad will happen if you abandon some of your habit energy. And that risk may feel really, really big. There's that risk that everything will totally fall apart. But I doubt that that's going to happen. There's the risk that you won't get everything crossed off your to-do list. But you know what? You probably never will anyway. You're going to keep adding stuff there. Better to find peace with the to-do list and realize that it's an endless process, not a thing you're going to complete." There's also the risk that something bad will happen if you continue to be governed by your habit energy. And we know what that is. We feel it in our hearts. We feel we're not fully living our lives. We feel we're kind of bundles of anxiety. I think I can feel it now. You know, I'm drinking my water, trying to be really quiet, but I can feel it under there. So that's habit energy, bringing this driving forward mode to all the things we do. So habit energy, by definition, is based on our reactions to past events. We determined at some point, consciously or maybe unconsciously, that a certain type of response was appropriate in a certain type of situation, and we started doing it automatically. So by definition, this habitual response is based on past conditions, not present conditions. And by definition, it's going to get things wrong some of the time. It's going to fit some of the time based on our past experience, but sometimes things aren't going to match up properly and it's going to miss the mark. It may miss the mark a lot of the time, maybe all of the time. Say I just retired and I have more time and I never need to drive that way again, but I still drive that way all the time. That's pretty unfortunate what my habit energy is doing to me there. So where does this habit energy come from? Well, that's really the big question, isn't it? In a way, asking that question is the essence of the Zen approach to this conundrum. Well, maybe not quite. Maybe it's not really about knowing where the habit energy comes from or being able to explain where it comes from. It's more about being present with it at the source when it arises, when it rears its ugly head, so that it can be felt and brought to the light, and then it can dissipate. You can be with it and allow it to unclench, allow it to dissipate, and maybe still not know consciously where it came from. You don't necessarily have to know. It may be knowable. It may be obvious. Maybe it's early training from a parent. You've got to drive forward no matter what. This is what matters in life. This is the bottom line. Or maybe you did this to yourself, as I suspect I did. Maybe you learned early on that that's the way to get results. Or maybe that's the way to get some love and attention. you know, we find the roles in our families that work for us. Or maybe you're acting out of fear. Maybe you're trying to control what is essentially uncontrollable. Knowing where it came from might help, but it's not necessary. You don't ask who shot the arrow. You get the arrow out. So there's a process for dealing with habit energy. And the first is seeing it. The easiest way to see it is in meditation. Because if you spend time in meditation and you follow your breath and you get things to really quiet down, then the workings of your mind are something you can watch. And you can see your habitual responses. And sometimes in a long retreat, these habitual responses will become very apparent. Oh, I'm doing that again. I've always been doing that, but I never saw that before. This little thing makes me react in this little way, over and over. And it's not helpful. And when your practice is more developed, you get attuned to this in your daily life. So that is seeing it. That is seeing how you are driven. You see it with your conscious mind, and you're able to reflect on it, but simultaneously there's something deeper going on too, which is that you are also being in the presence of this habit energy in a non-thinking way. You're just being there with it. And when this happens, you realize that you have a choice as to whether you will be controlled by the habit energy or whether you will gently turn away from it. And this may be an incremental process with wonderful small transformations. The possibility of a deep transformation is also there. It's best not to think too much about the results. But once habitual energy is altered, it's a new world. We see the world today for what it is, instead of seeing it through the lens of what we decided years ago is the proper way to interpret the world. There it is. We are free, and we get the breeze. Is there anything finer in this life than a cool breeze on a hot day? We can just be there with the breeze, and it's the first breeze we've ever felt, because we have no habits around the breeze. And there's nothing we have to do, nothing whatsoever. You can't take a picture of the breeze, so don't even try. You don't need to savor it or remember it, because next you're going to turn to the next thing, and you're going to find what that is. And it may be wondrous, and maybe not, but you're going to be there with it. Okay, so there is something more I need to say about this. And this has to do, you could say, with the accessibility of this practice. And one person asked me a while back about teaching Zen to a specific group of people, teaching Zen to prisoners. And the question was, you know, what does all this mean for this prison population that I'm teaching? You know, we tell these stories about ancient Chinese masters and stuff, and there's this kind of heady philosophical stuff. And they're right there in their day-to-day life, probably just trying to survive. And how is this relevant for them? So there's the fact that this practice may be more accessible to some than to others. And someone could say, well, Ted, all of this is pretty easy for you to say, maybe easy for you to do because of your own circumstances. And I realize that that's true, because I do, obviously, enjoy various levels of privilege based on my race, my gender, my sexual orientation, my physical ability, lots of things have made my path easier in many ways. Not everyone has peonies in front of their house, and not everyone has a place for the robins to build a nest. Not everyone has the time or the means to drive down the river for the weekend. And maybe discarding habit energy is easier for some than others. And let me explain that. Sometimes our habit energy can help us to survive. And here's a pretty good example, which was suggested to me by something Ben said the other day. Different people can have very different experiences of the same thing based on what they bring to it. Say there's a situation where I'm out in public and there's some kind of a disruption and I'm peripherally involved and someone calls the police. For me, I might think, well, that's good. The police are here to protect me. And I feel pretty good about that. But if I were, say, my grandson, who just graduated, Alonzo, who is Hispanic, his experience might be very different. He might be fearful. To me, he looks like this sweet kid who just graduated. To them, he may look like a potential gang member. If I were him, I might fear that because the police are there, I'm going to be automatically treated as a suspect. And it's not going to be too far from my mind that it could even be much worse. And this is the reality all across the country. And a lot of people don't believe this, but it is true. And so there's a certain habit energy that can help us to survive, or at least it started out that way. Certain situations indicate danger, and our habitual response can actually save us. If someone is about to attack you, you don't have time to think it over. You rely on your habitual response. You see the police car and your senses are heightened. But the important point here is that even if a habitual response is helpful in some situations, if we overdo it, it's going to get us in trouble. And I think this is most easily understood when thinking in terms of response to trauma. So post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, I think is best understood as a habitual response that arose out of a helpful protective impulse. But due to the extreme nature of trauma, it went way beyond its usefulness. And then it showed up in all sorts of situations where it was inappropriate. So you can think of PTSD as an extreme form of habit energy. That fight-or-flight response was initially helpful. Our circumstances taught us that we've got to have that hyper-awareness. But then when we become hyper-aware in every part of our lives, even the parts where we are safe, it wears us out. It's inefficient, and it may get us in trouble because we see the police car and we run, and then they chase us. So PTSD is a tough nut to crack, and sometimes meditation is not the best thing for it. It may be a bad thing for it. Maybe for PTSD, the best thing is to work with a mental health professional and engage in Zen practice consisting of community and ritual and mindful work and talking to a teacher, and maybe eventually meditation when the time is right. And the point I'm trying to make here, and I hope I'm able to make it because I'm wading into difficult waters, is that no matter what our circumstances are, no matter how extreme our habit energy is, we can benefit from sorting out which layers of our habit energy are useful and which are not. We can benefit from watching ourselves and saying, we might say, okay, I'm grieving right now and habit energy is really comforting right now and I'm grateful for it. And we might say, though, on the other hand, wait a minute, this response is totally not appropriate to this situation. And the most important thing is to know that. That unhelpful response can be undone. This is something anyone can work on and anyone can benefit from. No matter how damaged we are from whatever circumstances, no matter how set in our ways we are, no matter how old we are, no matter, it doesn't matter. We can open up. So, as I said, it is my wish that we all may be able to enjoy this beautiful time of year. And I'd like to add that it's my wish that we'll all support each other in this endeavor. Let's take the risk that we might examine our habit energy and learn to let go of the parts that are not helpful, and take the risk that all of this may outweigh the benefits of that relentless driving forward to get things done, to stave off disaster. So today, you probably have stuff to do. You probably have things scheduled like I do. But if you're lucky enough to just have this Sunday to do whatever you want, how about doing something anti-habitual? How about doing something you don't usually do? How about walking out of Zen Center or walking out of your house with an open heart, but with the appropriate protections, of course, and seeing what your open heart finds? How about wandering without destination? How about letting the world come to you? It sounds risky, I know, but staying in that old groove is risky too. And of course, it's all about finding the balance. Wisdom, and you must have wisdom if you're going to do this practice, is finding the proper balance between habit and adventure. No one can tell you what that balance is for you. A teacher may help you to explore it, and the answer may keep changing. I just hope you'll keep at it, and I hope you'll enjoy the process, and I hope you feel that Zen Center and the Sangha here, the teachers here, the staff here, are all here to support you. And you have my gratitude for considering what it is that I had to say today. So thank you very much. And we have some time. If anyone has a question or a comment, I would be happy to hear that. Jim?
There's a sociology book called The Young TV and the 10 Mile Per Hour Car. And it has, and I don't remember the name of the author, but he has exercises in there, like go into an elevator and face the back wall and find out what you feel about that and see the reactions of people with you, and kind of push them against habitual.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Face the back of the elevator when people are in it to push against traditional habits. I don't know if I would do that one, because an elevator is such a little space, you know, and it could make people nervous. I might do that in a different place. But I get what you're saying about just doing things differently.
Well, he also addresses, you know, you wouldn't want to drive your car at 10 miles per hour on the street because he'd make a lot of people mad.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Jim. Yes?
Hi, my name's Austin. I think it was 6 or so months ago the first time I heard the idea of habit energy either.
Mm-hmm.
And my first thought was transforming. So I have this lazy, you know, bad habit energy that has me, let's just call it a little overweight.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea is, was before today, to just change it totally, use all of it and send it in a different direction that's positive and helpful. So today, with you talking about kind of releasing it or not putting as much emphasis on it, I'm sitting here trying to accept that thought caused a stirring in me, and I felt it over here, but it was really bubbling up inside me, right? Not give it energy, just acknowledge it, but kind of surf it out. That caused a stirring in me. So I'm definitely thankful for this conversation because it gave me a different way of looking at it. And I'm going to try to apply some of that. Because I like the idea of habit energy and what that means for my, you know, the way I use the power or energy that I have on a daily basis. I just have to try to reframe it and not give it so much authority in my life, I guess. I don't know quite how to look at it yet, but I'm going to give it a lot more thought.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. Yeah. Deb. And then Jeff.
Kind of examine the source of the habit and energy and kind of figure out why it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, you know, what's the kind of the basis of this. When I'm diving, I think I need to get far. I think, what's the advantage of being up there versus back there?
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, not too much. So.
Yeah.
And it just kind of changes my attitude about driving faster.
Mm-hmm.
And you never see what's behind you, you know, ever.
Uh-huh.
So you can only see what's in front of you. But I think there's really no disadvantage for being back there.
Right.
It just kind of changed my attitude about driving faster.
Yeah, yeah. We just do these things because we've always done them. Yeah, thanks, Deb. Jeff.
Thank you so much for your talk. Especially, I think, the part of when we were talking about the extreme forms of habit energy based on trauma. My life has opened up at this point in a way that has allowed me to have some deep conversations with two people who both have experienced extreme trauma in their lives, much worse than anything I have ever experienced. And on the one hand, one of these people has been able to metabolize that trauma in a healthy way with help from other people. And that person now serves as an exemplary figure to me.
Mm-hmm.
The way they are leading their lives and in the way they are healing others and society at great cost to themselves still. The second person, unfortunately, has not been able to take that step. And he continues to blow that trauma that he has suffered out into the world around him,
mm-hmm,
in ways that cause other people to have massive trauma or other beings. I was engaged in a conversation with that person about 3 days ago, and we were having a very deep conversation on the back patio of the home that that person lives in. And a squirrel came out and started to run up the tree. And that person reached into their pocket and pulled out a combat knife and was getting ready to throw it at the squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
Unaware of the fact that had he done so, the knife would have gone into his own body, into my body, into his mother's body, that there is no difference. But these are great teachings for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thank you very much for your opening out this whole question.
Yeah. 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 Well, I'm glad you had that conversation, and I hope he's able to have more conversations like that, and he's able to transform, you know, to transform. I hope it happens.
I hope so, too.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. Wanda.
There's a Native American story that I've shared in my Dharma talks here before, but I think it really applies here, and it's a great story.
Mm-hmm.
The grandfather talking to his grandson, and he tells him that everybody has two wolves inside of them,
mm-hmm,
the wolf and the bad wolf, and they're always fighting. And, you know, the bad wolf represents hatred, anger, intolerance, all of which is habit energy, all of which is conditioned upon something that we learned in the past and we're attending to. And so he said that's the characteristic nature of the bad wolf. And the good wolf is all these things that relate to just being open to the situation as it truly is.
Mm-hmm.
So then the grandson says, at the end of this description, the grandson says, well, which wolf will win? And the grandson says, the one you feed.
Yes.
So that was pertaining to, I thought of that when you told your talk a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
It's a great story to remember because it relates on so many different levels of our experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which wolf will win? The one you feed the most. Yeah. Yeah, and this relates to the idea of storehouse consciousness and seeds in there. Yogacara, Ben's book, Vasubandhu's 30 Verses. Anyone who's interested in exploring this in depth in a more explicitly Buddhist context can read that book. Yeah, thanks, Wanda. Yes?
I have a question.
Why did he say that PTSD, that meditation may not be appropriate for someone with PTSD? Speaking of someone that has been through a fair amount of trauma in my life, meditation and stilling my mind is one of the best things that's happened.
Well, oh, that's wonderful. So yeah, go ahead and do it if it's working. But I've talked to, you know, I'm not an expert, I'm not a psychologist, but I've talked to some psychologists about this because I'm interested in it. And what I'm told is that if one meditates and you know you find yourself going over the trauma again in your mind, and you can't escape that. It's not really helpful, and it can actually kind of reinforce the trauma, and that's the reason. But that's not true for everyone, and for some people, meditation is a really wonderful antidote for PTSD. But if I talk to a student who has PTSD, I always say, you know, I think it'd be good to work with a psychologist and kind of see if meditation is the right thing, get their opinion on it. So does that answer your question? Okay, great. Yes?
I would just comment about PTSD. There's different degrees, and in the most severe cases, it's a question of your personal survival. The trauma affects your continued life or existence, and oftentimes the trauma can be so difficult or so abnormal to normal human behavior that rather than reliving it, you repress it and you don't remember it for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you still act on it. The strategies that develop under that trauma situation to help you survive get imprinted subconsciously, and they'll come out involuntarily at later times.
Mm-hmm.
When you're under stress. And oftentimes those strategies will then be not only inappropriate, but often, you know, borderline rational.
Right.
So you know, when the trauma is that severe, you have to work it out. And for veterans, probably the best way is to talk with other veterans because there's that empathy or that understanding.
Right. Right.
And meditation doesn't hurt, but it may not relieve that suppressed trauma. You know, it's something that will help you develop to the point where you can open up and allow that to work through. And what happens then is the trauma doesn't go away, but you gain control over the involuntary responses to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. And one thing about meditation is you do that alone and maybe, you know, conversing with other people who have had similar circumstances.
I just would say a little bit more about the overall conversation today.
Mm-hmm.
The meditation, we use that to actually calm ourselves to get to a point where there's a sense of serenity or a sense of relief. We do that together in this room or by ourselves. The real challenge is to maintain that when we get up and walk out of the
sure,
hall or
sure,
away from wherever we were meditating. And the freeways seem to be almost designed to interrupt us. To get us going so fast that we can't make decisions quick enough to get where we're going. Oh, I just missed my exit.
Uh-huh.
So I think we need to imagine a driving Buddha and become him when we're out there.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Maybe one or two more?
Or as it may be.
Yeah. Anyone else? Okay.
I just wanted to thank everyone for sharing this way, in terms of my own personal traumas that I dealt with, and also because I deal with populations that are refugee populations and people that live in extreme poverty. So I know that, you know, this is something that we're just beginning to be aware of. You know, they've kind of layered these layers that we're going to help you, you know, improve your lives and bring you to a point of safety. But we know now, you know, that underlying trauma doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the importance of communities where you're willing to, I think meditation for me has been really important too, but I truly recognize the importance of being a part of a community, of being in a place where you have people to talk about those feelings. It's really crucial. So for all these people that I serve, I realize, oh, God, there's a reason I'm there. Not because I put out, like, maybe revamp their lives, but at least, you know, there's a point of contact where there's somebody that's helping us.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, one more. Val.
Thank you. This has been extremely helpful because for the last 3 months I spend some hours a week at a facility where people have, on average, about 7 to 10 days of life left, just listening to them and letting them express themselves. I haven't heard a lot of regret or I wish I had done these things, but it forces me, at my stage of life, to see myself in their place and the things that I will possibly look back and wish I'd done better. But this has been very helpful, Ted, and I appreciate it greatly because we're all creatures of some degree of habit. And Candy looked at carefully and addressed and changed for the better and even eliminated in some cases. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for those beautiful comments.